We're doing Jewish history. We were up to the year 3408, and we had gone off on a slight tangent about the relationship that different kings had with Jerusalem, with the Beit HaMikdash, and he recorded that we had this golden era where even Greek kings would send gifts to the Beit HaMikdash. And he had quoted that there was this king, Asisa, who also sent gifts to the Beit HaMikdash, and there was Ptolemy, the Egyptian king, who was also called, I don't know how you pronounce this, Ayorgiti, I don't know how you pronounce it, that he was victorious in his military campaigns against the Assyrian empires, and when he came back to Egypt, he didn't offer sacrifices to his gods, but rather he sent his sacrifices up to Jerusalem. So our neighbors had this awe, this respect of the Beit HaMikdash at this time. And we know the story of Alexander, that at the beginning of the Second Temple period, he said, I have a dream before my wars, and I see an angel that looks like the Kohen Gadol. There was Alexander, the father of Tibreo, one of the Caesars that spent a lot of money in order to finance 9 doors that would be sent to Israel as the doors of the Heichal and the Ezras Nashim, that this Alexander wanted to beautify the Beit HaMikdash, and then his son Tivreo didn't want that Pilati, his governor in Jerusalem, will put up golden shields in the Beit HaMikdash. In King David's time, he had golden shields all around the Beit HaMikdash, shields made of solid gold. And he wouldn't let him put up those shields because on those shields was inscribed the name of the donor. And he said, you shouldn't have a donor's name in the Beit HaMikdash. That's how much respect they had, even the Greek kings, for the Beit HaMikdash. We move on to Pompey, the Roman general, that if we step fast forward later on in the Second Temple period, we have two brothers, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, who are both sons of Yanai, that when Pompey was passing nearby, the Roman general, so again, he also gave a lot of his wealth in order to beautify the Beit HaMikdash. So we're going off on this tangent describing the highlights of the period of the second Beit HaMikdash, where non-Jewish kings in general would fund the beautification of the Beit HaMikdash. We're in the middle, but we'll take a question. Yeah?
So a goy can't touch my wine, but he can send gifts that I have no idea what his intention. He sent a gift.
Right.
What he would have done to that wood.
Right.
Done in intentions. In,
right. 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 Exactly, yeah. Yeah. The logic is that the reason the rabbis forbade the wine that a non-Jew touches is not really because I'm so concerned he libated it for an idol. Chazal said that if we're going to drink alcohol with non-Jews, it will easily lead into intermarriage. So they said, being that we have a prototype, that the Torah forbade drinking wine that was libated to an idol, and the non-Jews were very into this, as you can see, if you happened across the text of Homer, Iliad, Odyssey, you see that this was a common thing. Anytime they came across wine, they felt they had to libate it in honor of the gods. So the rabbis took a biblical concept and expanded it rabbinically and said, anytime a non-Jew touches wine, a Jew shouldn't drink that wine. They fashioned it around the biblical prohibition. But it wasn't that they were saying, hey, from now on, any non-Jew is suspect that every split second they libated it. That's the legal format of the institution, but that's not the reasoning behind the institution. The reasoning behind the institution was because the rabbis saw that if Jews and non-Jews would be drinking alcohol together, then intermarriage would be the natural next step. Coming back to here. So we have the general Cicero Augustus, who was also, he became the Caesar after Pompey. And when he heard that the Beit HaMikdash was a place where there were no pictures, no one could have their picture in the Beit HaMikdash. So he said, okay, so this place is a place of truth. This is a place I respect. He said, I want to designate that every day they bring a sacrifice that's my sacrifice in this place that represents truth and purity, a cow and two sheep. And his wife also donated to the Beit HaMikdash gold and silver vessels. So he's giving us a listing of, spanning a few centuries, the Second Temple period, the different donations that non-Jews made in appreciation of the Beit HaMikdash. And this Cicero, when he became the Caesar, he commanded that gifts that were sent should be sent to the Beit HaMikdash. Even though ordinarily the Roman rule was that money had to stay within a country, they didn't allow money to travel easily between the countries. They made a leniency that they could transfer money if it was headed to Jerusalem. Special leniency, you could send donations to Eretz Yisrael, to the Beit HaMikdash. He also made another leniency that Jews could build as many shuls and batei midrash, and as many academies as they want, even if they're doing it outside Israel, and even though other nations had to get a special license to build a temple in Rome, under other nations that were under Roman rule, but the Jews were allowed to build temples without license. They were given a free license to build batei midrash and shuls. If we talk about Cleopatra, the Egyptian queen, so she also sent great gifts to the Beit HaMikdash, and she also sent people. When people would talk to her, she encouraged them, go see that temple in Jerusalem. And she sent, she was a fundraiser. Whenever she'd meet with different kings, she'd say, I want you to send a gift. Send a donation up the way of the Beit HaMikdash. And year after year, she increased the wealth of the Beit HaMikdash by promoting the Beit HaMikdash internationally. Yes?
When it comes to Cleopatra, I know she was on the side of Mark Anthony. Wasn't Herod on the side of Augustus? And so how did this work, especially her being a fundraiser to a temple that her own enemy was building? How does that...
It could be, I don't know, but sometimes the temple crossed party lines,
Okay. Which
is what was supposed to happen when the Kingdom of Judea and Israel were split, and that's what should have happened, which didn't happen during the time that brought down the destruction. But it could be that at this time it still remained... apolitical. The temple was supposed to remain apolitical. It didn't. Much of the time of Second Beit HaMikdash, the Kohanim were dragged into the politics, the rabbis fled the temple, and there was all kinds of inappropriate things going on in the temple. We know the Kohen Gadol was appointed based on money, based on political clout, but this also explains another thing we discussed in the end of last year. We saw that a lot of the arguments over who would be Kohen Gadol were about the control of the temple fund. Meaning in the Beit HaMikdash, there was a vast storages of wealth. And we asked last year, where did all this wealth come from? But if the nations had this great respect for the Beit HaMikdash, and you had gifts coming in from all these nations the way he's recording, so then perhaps that's where the wealth of the Beit HaMikdash was so built up. We saw at the end of last year, we discussed the idea that the fight to be Kohen Gadol did not stem from piety. It stemmed from a desire to control the wealth of the Beit HaMikdash. And And that wealth, the Kohen Gadol, for much of the Second Temple period, he was the one who called the shots as to what would happen with that wealth. There were pious Kohanim Gadolim who tried to divert it and change the control to the courts, to the high court, to the rabbis, to have a consensus. But the next Kohanim Gadolim were able to annul those institutions. Yeah, it wasn't long-lived. We end with Neron Caesar. That even Neron, who would ultimately attack the temple until the Jews rebelled against him, he used to send his own sacrifices to the Beit HaMikdash. He'd say, this is an amulet. This will help me succeed in my wars. So this is a brief overview of the four centuries of the Second Temple, the different generals and kings who valued the Beit HaMikdash and were personally invested in the Beit HaMikdash. As you're saying, it seems like sometimes it crossed party lines. That's what it seems like, which would be a nice thing, which would be what we would expect. It's not exactly the picture our sages portray of this period. Meaning in the Talmud and Tractate Yuma, the sages portray it as a long period, centuries of Kohanim Gdolim who were not worthy, who didn't live out their year. They'd be Kohen Gadol, they'd do whatever they did, and then they didn't live out their year. Next year you had someone else up there. So that's the picture that's portrayed in the Talmud, which doesn't sound like it crossed party lines. It doesn't sound that way. And the whole story of Herod also involved a little bit of what was going on in the Beit HaMikdash. Don't forget that Herod initially pursued the rabbis, which means he abolished the high court in the Beit HaMikdash, meaning he established his high court of Sadducees as he tried to annihilate the Pharisees. I'm saying Herod initially took sides with the Sadducees to the point where he was ready to kill and did kill as many rabbis as he could find, which is a direct impact on the Beit HaMikdash, which means the Beit HaMikdash was given into the control of the Sadducees. It was taken away from our tradition, and suddenly the temple was being run by Sadducees. The high court was being run by Sadducees because you couldn't show your face if you weren't a Sadducee. So this does beg a few questions, agreed. Meaning exactly how the temple was valued during these times of internal strife is a good question. I don't know.